Matthew 24. We would like to begin in just a moment with verse 15 and eventually make our way down through verses 16 through 20. This should be a pretty good chunk of the chapter. Up to this time, we've shown that Jesus has said various things about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. It was a very bad time. He said that things leading up to that time, there would be war, there would be rumors of wars, there would be division, kingdom against kingdom, verse 7, earthquakes in various places. But these things were just like almost a ramp. He said that these things were the beginning of the travail, as we find in verse 8. And then he talked about the persecution. We looked at some cross-references for what that involved, the false prophets leading people astray, how people, as this process got worse and worse, the love of many would grow cold. Verse 13, but people needed to preserve their faith, and they needed to persist if they wanted to survive through this. Then in verse 14, we also said, we drew some parallels between that verse and Colossians 1 and some other passages to show that the first century church was very good at spreading the gospel. Then we come down to verse 15, continuing the thought about the destruction of Jerusalem. He says, when therefore ye see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let him that readeth understand. And then, of course, he's going to go on to some other things. This is where we left off last time. And Jesus, as he addressed this information, he said that the reader could understand. Well, there may be some difficulties associated with understanding what he had to say, but at least I think we can get the big picture and the vast majority of what he intended for us to know. As he talks about this, he mentions the abomination, and that doesn't sound good, but he mentions the abomination of desolation. Even if we didn't know what that was, we know what desolation is, don't we? Somebody says, this is desolate. What's he saying? All right, it's bare, it's abandoned, it's a place perhaps that's been ravaged, and these kinds of things. The Lord said, in talking about this abomination of desolation, that it was something that Daniel the prophet had written about many years earlier. He also referred to standing in the holy place. Well, out of all that information, standing in the holy place is probably the easiest part to unravel. You remember that the Jewish people, they had the temple, and if you were the high priest, you could go in once a year to what area? The Holy of Holies. Well, he doesn't mention that here. He talks about the holy place, which would have been the outer area. And in this place, in this instance, I think Jesus is using the holy place to describe the whole temple complex. And that's one more way of saying we're dealing with something that's not related to the future. We're dealing with something that was associated with the time period of the first century, specifically the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, if you listen to some people teach, and I'm not typically talking about members of the church, but if you listen to some religious people teach, they will turn to Matthew 24, verse 15, some other passages in the Bible, Old and New Testament verses, to say some wild things are going to take place in the future. They would use, for example, passages from Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48. They would go back to the book of Daniel, and if we've got time, we'll look at some things from Daniel chapter 9, but in this case, Daniel 9, verse 27. They'd also use Daniel 11, 31, 2 Thessalonians 2, where Paul talks about the man of sin, and Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2 that we talked about not too long ago, to say that there's going to come a time. Now, I don't believe this. I don't think the Bible teaches this. But there's some people who claim that there's going to come a time when at least one more temple is going to be built over there in the area of Jerusalem on that old Temple Mountain. And some would even say that there is going to be come a time when even two temples are going to be built. The people who believe that kind of thing, they talk about other things as well. They would make references to a rapture, a word that we don't find in the Bible. And they think that at the future time, whenever this temple or temples are built, people are there going to learn about how to properly worship God and God's holiness. Well, don't we have those things now? How to worship God? I mean, if we don't, it's kind of like, you know, the hour, the day is getting very, very late. Well, one of the problems with that is if you go over to Jerusalem and you look at what is considered the traditional site for the Temple on the Mount, is that already occupied?
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit of a problem. Who's got it?
Muslims.
The Muslims have it. And what's there? It's that big dome of the rock. I mean, that's the holy spot. Well, if you intend for your temple or your temples to be built there, you don't have too many options. Those fellows are probably not going to just sign over the property and say, well, hey, you want to build a temple? Here you go. So some people have the idea that God is going to send a big earthquake. That earthquake is going to take care. It's going to wipe out that Dome of the Rock. But, you know, even if that were to occur, which I don't think you've got any biblical basis for that, you still have today, even if your house gets wiped out by an earthquake, don't you still own something? You still own the property. So how that would change things between the believers in this stuff and the people who believe in the Islamic faith, I have no idea, but that's one idea. But other people have the idea that, and I've never been there, but as you look at pictures of it, people have the idea that, well, we're just going to build a temple in that general area. But it's kind of like gas and water. Those two things don't mix very well. But that's what a lot of people believe. They think that there's going to come a great mass of conversions to Christianity based on some false ideas from Romans 11, Revelation 7, Revelation 14. There are some other claims that there's going to be a rapture. That's all part of this, the Battle of Armageddon, that, Lord willing, we'll talk about this coming Sunday, and the unbelieving Jews are going to be killed. If you tune into some of these guys on the TV station, they've got some neat graphics up there about, you know, World War III and how bad it's going to be, and a picture of a grandiose temple at the end of time, and all those kinds of things. And then you finally get to the end of the story, and then you've got the rise of the Antichrist, supposedly, and fiction is really what it is as far as religious information. But there's a lot of stuff that's involved with that. As you hear these people talk, it's almost always the case that they will come back to Matthew 24, verse 15, and they say, well, the abomination of desolation, it's in the future. Well, as we're looking at Matthew 24, what are we seeing? Where is it? Future or past? It's past. And as Jesus continues to develop the thought, as we'll look in a little bit with verses 16 through 20, he makes that very, very clear. Let's say a little bit, though, about the word abomination. It's a word that describes a lot of things in the Bible. We'll not look at the references, but it will give you the things that we find associated with it. Idol worship, it's an abomination. Worship, Isaiah chapter 1, verse 13, that is associated with the wrong spirit, God says it is an abomination. Sexual sin, lying, a lot of different things are associated with abomination. In the book of Daniel, this is a word that we find being used multiple times. There's the wing of abominations that we'll talk about if we have a little time, Daniel 9:27. There is the setting up of an abomination, Daniel 11:31. And there's also the making an abomination desolate in Daniel chapter 12, verse 11. Well, here, who's heard of Daniel's 70 weeks? I mean, hopefully you've read about it, but at least a few of us, Daniel's 70 weeks. I mean, it's there in the book of Daniel, and this is where a lot of people would go back and start building all this crazy stuff. But to sum things up, to give you a simple definition, when Jesus talks about the abomination of desolation, based on what we've said in tonight's class and preceding classes, would there be a simple explanation for that? What was the abomination of desolation? It was the destruction of Jerusalem. That's what Daniel was looking forward to many years prior to Jesus' time. That's what the Lord was looking forward to as he went through this chapter. Now, the parallel accounts, I've mentioned this before. This is one of the reasons why I gave out the parallel sheets earlier. If you look at the parallels for this plus a lot of the other stuff in Matthew 24, the parallels oftentimes help explain what Jesus is talking about. But a lot of times people act as if there are no parallels and they just say, well, here's the abomination of desolation, and they run off in many other places. Let's get a couple of helpers for our parallels. Let's take a look at Mark 13. We'll look at Mark 13, verse 14. That'll be Steve. And then after we have that read, we'll look at Luke's parallel. It's going to come from Luke 21, verse 20. Josh, you want to take that one? Luke 21, 20. Jeff, when you're ready, Mark 13, verse 14. 13, 14. Oh, I'm sorry, Steve. I was connecting the verse there, and that was not the right thing to do. 13:14.
You will see the awful horror standing in the place where he should not be. Then those who are in Judea must run away to the hills.
Okay. Now, that translation doesn't use the word abomination, but it talks about the awfulness of it. Well, that's what it was when Jerusalem was destroyed. And after mentioning the awfulness, the abomination, Steve, that latter part of the verse, let's read it again. Oh, well, that helps a little bit, doesn't it? When the abomination shows up, where do you need to run?
The high country,
over there in Judea, the mountains. Well, if this refers to the end of time, as a lot of people claim, the parallel account makes no sense whatsoever. So it is, as we go through Matthew 24, if you study this chapter on your own, if you talk to somebody about Matthew 24, make sure that you know the parallels are in Mark 13, Luke 21, and look at those parallels, because they will eliminate a lot of the error that people try to teach. Josh, Luke 21, verse 20.
But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near.
Okay, same idea here. Jesus says, Jerusalem. The desolation is going to come near when you see these kinds of things happening. Well, this makes perfect sense as you look ahead a little bit with verses 16 through 20. Jesus there, and we heard this alluded to from the other accounts. If you're in the area of Judea, flee to the mountains, don't go down to the housetops and so forth. And this was significant for these people. If you think back, if you were in the Wednesday or the VBS class that we had, we saw this on at least one night. That may have been Wednesday night, but there were maybe two nights that we talked about this. In that area, if you flee to the mountains in the area of Jerusalem, what shelter is available to you?
Caves.
Yeah, the caves. Literally filled with caves. Well, if you're focused on the city, you're going to go up there and do a hunt in the mountains, cave by cave by cave, trying to ferret people out? I'm not going to waste your time with that. You're going to stay focused on where the concentration of the people would be, that, of course, being in the area of Jerusalem. There are a lot of sources, and I think enough to believe that this is true. If you can remember how the nation of Jerusalem was structured, you have Galilee at the top, Samaria in the middle, and then you have Judea down at the bottom. There's a Jordan River that runs between the two seas. On the east side of that, you've got Jerusalem really on the other side. But on the east side of that, you have the Decapolis. One of the cities in Decapolis, this would have been a little south of the Dead Sea, was Pella, P-E-L-L-A. And history says that God's people were able to go there because of the warning that Jesus gave, and they saved their lives. Luke 22, verse 22, or maybe I think it's Luke 21, 22. Let's have that read as a cross-reference. I had Luke 22 in my notes, but I think it's Luke 21, verse 22. Josh, you still close to that? Okay.
For these are days of vengeance, to fulfill all that is written.
Okay. Now think about that. God says when it's time for the Romans to descend on Jerusalem, it is God's time for vengeance. Do you want to be anywhere close to the place where God is going to set forth his vengeance? It's going to be a time of terror. It's going to be an experience that people want to avoid. So the Lord made it very clear, this is not a place where you want to be. You want to be avoiding this. Josh, if you back up one verse, Luke 21, verse 21.
Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are inside the city depart, and let not those who are out in the country enter.
Okay, now here in verse 21, you have a detail, which is not in Mark 13 or in Matthew chapter 24. We've focused on the people who were there in the area of Jerusalem. Jesus said, when you see that the time has come for the Romans to invade the city, you flee. Go out there into the mountains in Judea, you can find the caves and so forth. But the flip side of that is, there were some people, you've got somebody that's working out there in the field, sees the Romans coming over the hill. What do you think his first inclination might be? Yeah. And not only go home, but if you've got the whole Roman army coming after you, home might not provide all the fortification you want, depending on where it's located. So if your house is out there in the country, what might be your first inclination? Where do you want to flee?
Head for the walled city.
You head for the fortified city. There are walls there. There are defenses there. But Jesus knew how this battle was going to go. So warning number one, if you're in the city, get out. If you're outside the city, don't use that first inclination, because if you go to the city of Jerusalem, what's going to happen? They're going to encircle the city, and you're going to die. So even for the people who are out in the country, even the people who are outside that fortified city, the Lord made it very, very clear that this was not going to offer them any protection. And that's often contrary to the way that we think and reason, but the Lord said that this was something that needed to be done here. So this word abomination, you have the destruction of Jerusalem that is definitely involved with it. But I think that there is a second idea that's associated with it. If you were a Jew, you have your religion, you have the temple there, and that's where the sacrifices are offered. You probably brought some sacrifices to the priest. And in your mind, the temple is the holy area. This is the place where God meets his people. What would be a way to defile that temple? What would be the one act that, it would just set you off like nothing else? Well, unauthorized is that would be part of it. Anybody want to take a shot at the second part of that? What will those unauthorized people do? All right. Let's enter into the holy place. Looking at this from the standpoint of the Romans, let's enter into the holy place and let's offer a sacrifice. Not only will we offer a sacrifice, if you really want to defile the place, what kind of sacrifice do you offer? Okay, you offer something that is associated with paganism, Satanism, and in this case you could do that. There were some clean and unclean animals Remember, under the Old Testament law, anybody recall what one of those animals was that was unclean? Had to avoid it if you were a Jew.
Pig.
The pig. And that actually happened. This happened about 168 AD, or 168 BC, about 200 years before this time. There was a fellow, a Greek tyrant, who came to the area of Jerusalem and really did some damage to the Hebrew people. He enslaved some of the Hebrew people. He told the Jews that they could not offer sacrifices, and he defiled the temple area. Anybody remember the Maccabean Revolt? Okay, well, if you go back and you look at history, that revolt was based on what this fellow did. A couple hundred years go by, and now Jesus says, guess what? And this may have been rolling around in the minds of the disciples, what happened 200 years prior as Jesus is going through this. He's saying, there's going to be an abomination. Well, maybe they're thinking, well, hey, 200 years ago, we remember what happened to the Jewish people. But only this time the Lord says what? It's going to be far, far worse. If you can remember that history from two centuries ago, God says, the Lord said, this time it's going to be really bad. And it was bad the first time. During that first time, there was a statue of Jupiter that was built. You've got the pig on the altar and so forth. Prohibition against temple worship, but this time it was going to be really, really bad. Now, I say all this to help connect an Old Testament reference that we're probably familiar with. Let's go back to the book of Genesis for a second. Genesis 49:10. This is a prophecy that we've probably read many times and maybe heard discussed a few times, but it's one that if we were asked to explain it, we probably would struggle a little bit. Genesis 49, verse 10. Who'd like to be a reader and our helper for it? All right, Jeff.
The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him to be the obedience of the peoples.
Okay. This Old Testament prophecy essentially said that Judah, one of the tribes there in the southern section of Israel, it was not going to lose its prominence until Shiloh came. Anybody want to make a guess as to who Shiloh was? Jesus, Christ. All right. By the time of 70 AD, had the Lord come? Yeah. All right. So if the scepter, if that power was going to stay in Judah until, or it was going to last at least until the Lord came. Once the Lord came, there about 30 AD, he's doing his ministry and so forth. There's no doubt that the Messiah has arrived and he's God's chosen. It is at that point, then Genesis 49:10 says what? Then, now, from Judah, this can be taken away. Well, it wasn't taken away immediately. It lasted for about 40 years. But it's interesting to me that you have the prophecy in Genesis 49:10. Literally thousands of years take place. The promised one comes. And now God says, Judah can get socked. And it did. It had its glory taken away in ways that we probably can't imagine. All right. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with verses 16 through 20? Okay. Let's look at these verses, and then whatever time we have left, we'll go back and take some information from Daniel 9. Beginning with verse 16. Then let them that are in Judea flee unto the mountains. Let him that is on the housetop not go down and take things out of his house. And let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. But woe unto them that are with child, to them that give suck in those days. And pray ye that your flight be not on the winter, neither on the Sabbath. As you look at the verses, and once again, this is a passage which reminds us that we need to be very, very careful as we study God's Word. He talks about the abomination of desolation, verse 15. And then in most translations, what's that next word in verse 16? Then. When the abomination of desolation occurs, then. Notice the connection. The two are joined very, very carefully and very, very definitely. So you've got to see a connection between the two. All right, Jesus says the abomination of desolation, the destruction of Jerusalem, is occurring, and it is at that point. Then people from where? Judea, that southern section of Israel, what were they to do? Flee. Now, you probably would guess about this, but I mention this point to, again, emphasize that we're not dealing, when we talk about the abomination of desolation, with something in our time or later. Jesus says, I want you to flee. Is it possible to flee from God when the Lord's going to come back at the end of time? No. Can't do it. As he talks about this word flee, would you like to make a guess as far as a tense? It's present. Jesus says you need to basically start running and you need to keep on running. Is it going to be possible to do that with God at the end of time? Be like an outlaw? You just start to run and he's not going to be able to catch up? No. Nobody believes that. Well, the present tense is one more way of saying this is something that relates to the earth. It is something that relates to the first century. It is not something that relates to the end of time. But it did occur about 40 years after this time. The Romans were coming, and as we heard from Luke 21, Josh, you want to flip back over there? I think we read verses 22, then we read verse 21. Let's also pick up verse 20. Luke 21:20.
But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near.
Okay. We said before that we have kind of a three-stage process here. Jesus says there are some things that are going to take place in the beginning. There'll be a warning. You'll see some things that take place as the process is unfolding. And then there will also be the aftermath. And that's laid out pretty well in Matthew 24. And here's one more reminder of that. As we think about the beginning, and it really was a kind of a ramp that led up to the destruction of Jerusalem. About 4 years, about 66 AD, 4 years before the time that Jesus really described in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, the people in Judea decided that they were going to rebel against Rome. There were some things that they didn't like. Well, that's not smart. When you have a nation that's as powerful as Rome, probably not a good idea to engage in open rebellion. And that caused several thousand troops to be sent into the area. Well, the Jews were successful initially in resisting this military force. And that's also bad news. When a big nation sends in some troops, if you are successful in resisting that advance, it's kind of like with Egypt right now. People think that they have a little victory and they're out there hollering in the streets and thinking, well, we've won, and everything is really great. Well, you might have won that first battle, but don't expect to win the war. Because of the Jews' success, Nero, he was a famous Roman emperor that was very evil. He enlisted his greatest general, this was Titus, to fight against the Jews, and 50,000 troops were deployed. Nero finally dies. Another fellow, Vespasian, took his place. The war is halted for a couple more years. So, as I say, there are a lot of things that were unfolding prior to 780. This was not just something, bang, that came up like that. But there were a lot of preemptive actions. There were a lot of initial things. And that's why Jesus, as we sort through Matthew 24, there's a lot of buildup to what he's talking about here. But eventually, Nero died. Vespasian took his place. And as I said, the war it stopped for a couple of years. Spring of 70 AD, the war is started again. Titus is the one that's now leading the charge, and his devastation was great, as predicted by Daniel and as spoken of by Jesus. As we look at verses 17 and 18, we have an additional demonstration of just how bad it was when Jerusalem was attacked and why people needed to act so quickly. As I read verse 17, your translation may have used the plural instead of the singular. Some translations may say something like garment. Other translations may say clothes, plural. And the difference is because of a manuscript distinction. Not all of them have the plural, not all of them have the singular. Jesus knew, too, about this particular country. If you look at the houses, and you can see this demonstrated in some other Old Testament passages. For example, David, he's looking at Bathsheba. You have what kind of rooftops in this area? They're flat. And usually there is an exterior staircase that allows you to come down the roof. So as far as moving from house to house or getting out of the house, it was structured a lot differently. And Jesus said, as you need to move quickly, the very structure of the houses is going to pose some difficulties for you. And he mentions a couple of examples. What are his examples that involve women? He says there will be some ladies who are pregnant. There will also be some ladies who are nursing. Now, if you've got to drop everything and run, you can imagine a nursing mom. Maybe she's got a couple of small kids, maybe four or five small children, or maybe she's got a baby that's a newborn, a few days or maybe a week or two old, or maybe she's 9 months pregnant, about ready to give birth. And the call goes out, the Romans are coming in, run! Can you imagine what that 7, 8, 9-month-old pregnant woman is going to do? Well, she's going to try her best, but trying to get down that staircase, trying to go from housetop to housetop, she's not going to be in a very good position. And even if she can get out of the house, she's not going to be able to run very far or run very well. So when Jesus presents this information, if you can imagine or if you can envision a situation where people are literally trying to run for their lives, they don't have time to go back and get a coat. They don't have time to go back and get their wallet, their purse, a cup of water. Jesus says, when you get the word, you absolutely need to flee. So this was a very, very bad situation. Then as you look carefully at the text, you find this point as well. He uses, as you look at the end of verse 19, but woe unto them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days. Well, when we think about the Lord's return, is it going to be a day or is it going to involve days? It's going to involve a single day. So there again, and I know it seems very repetitious, but when we have people talk about the abomination of desolation in verse 15, they just gloss over this other stuff. But if they would simply read what goes before and what comes after, including the reference to days, it should not be too difficult to realize that Jesus is not talking about something in our future. It was something that was in the past. Let's see, where else I wanted to give you. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say some things about verse 20? Okay, verse 20, here's another passage which further establishes that Jesus was talking about a local problem, something that involved the Hebrew people instead of a matter that affected the whole world. If you were living in the area of Jerusalem at this time, what would have happened on the Sabbath day? Anybody know? All right, it used to be kind of that way in our cities. We had the blue laws. And if you wanted to go to the mall, if you wanted to go to Walmart or Kmart, probably more Kmart back then instead of Walmart, you know, you could drive. There was no restriction as far as getting out in the roads, but the store would be locked up. Nowhere to go. Well, the Jews were even more involved with this kind of thing. They restricted travel, and they had the gates of the city. Remember, the people out there in the country, they'd want to come inside the city. And the Lord said, if it's the Sabbath day, you're trying to get out, guess what's going to be locked up? Those gates. So here again, as he talks about this abomination of desolation, he comes out, he talks about the days, he talks about the Jewish practices and so forth, and there's just no way to look at this information and say it somehow relates to our day and time. Let's pick up a couple cross-references to tell us a little bit about the Jews and the Sabbath day. Exodus 16:29, and then we'll go also back to the book of Nehemiah 13. Who wants to take care of Exodus 16, verse 29, Steve, and then Nehemiah 13, verses 19 and 22. Nehemiah 13, all right, Amy, 13, 19, and 22. Josh, Exodus 16:29. Oh, I'm sorry. Steve, I don't know why I got you too. I guess that was it. That's third time's a charm. Exodus 16:29.
Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath, that is why on the sixth day he gives you break for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where they are on the seventh day. No one is to go out.
Okay, very, very clear. Now, as you think about this passage and what we're talking about here, by the time the Romans came against Jerusalem, had the Sabbath day been done away with? Okay, I've got some yeses, I've got some noes. Let's ask that question again. All right, Jesus was there about 30 AD. When's Rome destroyed?
70.
So has Christianity been instituted yet?
Yes.
Okay, and with the institution of Christianity, what happened with the Sabbath day? It was eliminated. We now have the first day of the week. But the Sabbath day, as far as the Christian perspective, it was no longer binding. Did everybody become a Christian?
No.
Well, if the guy who's controlling the gate is not an adherent of Christianity, or the people who have control of that, likely the Sanhedrin, what's going to be true of the gate when the Romans come? It's going to be locked. And you could have probably tried to argue and persuade those people, but once again, hey, we're Jew, God has given us the temple and so forth, and you know we're not going to let people out. So very, very difficult thing because they were familiar with passages like Exodus 16:29. All right. Nehemiah chapter 13, 19 and 22. Amy?
And it came to pass that when the gates of Jerusalem began to be dark before the Sabbath, I commanded that the doors should be shut and commanded that they should not be opened till after the Sabbath. And some of my servants set eye over the gates that there should no burden be brought in on the Sabbath day. And then in verse 22, I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and that they should come and keep the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. Remember unto me, this also
Thank you. Now, we don't have all the details about what was done with the Sabbath day gate, or the gate there that was closed on the Sabbath day. But if you're a Jew, and you believe that the Sabbath is a day of rest, and nobody should be allowed to come in that gate, nobody should be allowed to go out that gate, human nature being what it is, what do you think some people might have done? Well, in addition to locking the gate, there may have been a guard there. And if you're going to try to get through the Sabbath, work on the Sabbath, if you're going to try to get through the gate, we'll kill you. So Jesus makes it very, very clear, do not try to flee on the Sabbath. Then he says something else as far as fleeing. What's the other point there in Matthew 24, verse 20?
In the winter.
One parallel between their situation and our situation, what happens in the winter months? Well, okay, let's hold on to that. That is one problem. But what else? Well, okay. What about the daylight? Winter, shorter days. True for us, true for them. So if you're wanting to flee, the longer that you have as far as the daytime, a whole lot better. You know, especially when you figure that they didn't have the kinds of lanterns and the other tools that we have. So there's that issue. Then you do have the other kinds of things. If you're fleeing and it's the wintertime, you know, you just can't grab some carrots on the way out or anything, you know, or go out and gather some out there in the mountains. It's going to be a lot tougher foraging for food. And then you have the problem that Marcia mentioned. Even in this part of the country that we're talking about, the area of Jerusalem, did it get cold? Yeah. In the winter months, you could have snow. Not only could you have snow, but you could have a lot of rain. Remember where I said a lot of these people went? They went to that area of Pella. Likely had to cross the Jordan River. So in the winter months, you can get rain. And what happens to your rivers when you get rain? We see it right now. They begin to swell and they begin to flood. So if you're trying to flee from the Roman armies and you come up against a river that may not be frozen, but it is a river which is gorging with water, and you're looking for a place to spot, or you're looking for a place, a spot to cross, and if you've been chased, well, that's going to be one more thing that's going to be very, very difficult as far as your escape. The temperature is also freezing. If you think back to what we talked about earlier, what if you're a pregnant mom? What if you're a mom with a child who's only a month or 2 months old? Here you are, you're trying to run. You've got the Romans maybe behind you if they decide to send out a little posse to pursue you. And in the process, you don't have time to go back. And Jesus says you don't have the time to go back and get your coat or your cloak, your clothes, no winter clothes. Baby's going to freeze to death. When he then talks about this tribulation, verses 21 and 22, as being as bad as the world has ever seen it, when you begin to put all these pieces together, it really was an awful, awful thing. Then when you consider the fact that the Jews, how do they consider themselves? We are God's chosen people. But this was what was happening to them. And it was kind of like, how can this possibly be? How can our temple be desecrated? How can women who are pregnant, how can women who are nursing, our young people, how can they be exposed to this? And Jesus says, as we heard from Luke 21, this is God's vengeance that's falling upon you. You rejected the Messiah, you did not do what's right, and now you're going to pay the price. And it was such a big deal that even the prophet Daniel had some things to say about it. Let's deal with a quick point as far as a practical point, see if there's anything that you might add or ask, and then we'll go back to Daniel 9 for just a bit. As the Lord predicted all of these things, what did he tell his people to do in Matthew 24, verse 20? He said, you should pray. I think that it's interesting that he told these people to pray. Would you like to guess about the tense that he used?
Ongoing.
It's ongoing. Jesus said, you pray, and you continue to pray. How much of a time span was there between what we have here in Matthew 24 and the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD?
40
about 40 years. I wonder, did he mean you pray over that 40-year period? Now, that's an interesting thought. Can you think of something that you might pray for over a period of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years? I mean, that's a long time to pray for something. All right, I think that's one thing. If you have a person who's not in a right relationship with God, let's say that we have a child that moves out at 18, potentially, given the life expectancy that people have today, you could pray for that child for close to half a century. That would be one example. What else? Praying for something that long?
For your kids, for our
well, all right. I think as we think about our children, as they go through life, whichever side of the fence they end up on when it comes time to become a Christian, that would be one thing. What about praying for a marriage? Well, I think that would be another thing, you know, as people go through life. Anything else?
No.
All right, I think that's another thing that would merit attention for many years. What about our nation?
Yeah.
Something people can pray for throughout their lives. So when we think about Matthew 24, verse 20, you have here a passage which you might describe as long-term prayer. Very interesting. All right, then let's see what we have as far as the... Stan? Yeah, you know, we know that Jesus was around 30. By this time, he's probably around 33 because he's close to the end of his life. How old were the other apostles that he had? If we think that he had contemporaries, that they basically were around 30, then you would have some of them that were around 70 years old at this time. And I mean, for that day and time, that was, you know, that was getting up there. But still there, I mean, John, some think that he was still alive in 90 A.D., you know, he apparently lived to a ripe old age. Some of them, certainly, when you look at Acts 12, you have James. He was killed by the sword. Herod took his life and some others. So how many of them lived? I don't know. I think it's fair to say when you look at Acts 12, there were some others that didn't make it until that time. But four, I think, the apostles, and surely they communicated this to some others as well, because the warning was for, you know, all God's people in this area. So even if they were not specifically part of this group, that there would have been others that throughout that time would have been encouraged to pray as well. So maybe not all of them prayed for that entire period, but at least I think we can say that there was that encouragement during that time from what we have here to the time of 70 AD to pray about it.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is if you're going to be praying about it, then you believe it's going to happen.
Right.
Then why in the world would they even still be there?
Well, you find that it seems like Jerusalem was a place where, you know, started out there as far as the beginning of Christianity, and maybe in some respects it always seemed like a home base because so much had started there. But I don't know. There are some traditions about the apostles going to other areas, places like India, places that we might associate with modern Russia, those kinds of places today. But how long they stayed in the area of Jerusalem, I don't know. Let's pick up with a different part of that thought that Stan introduced. Could they change what was going to take place as far as Jerusalem's destruction? No. Could they alter anything? Well, okay, there was that. Could they alter the season? Well, let's see. Let's go back and look at 20 again. He says, "And pray ye that your flight or your escape be not in the winter, neither on a Sabbath." Could they pray that they would not have to escape during the winter? Yes. Well, if it wasn't possible to change that or have any effect on that season when they were going to escape, would there have been any use in praying for it? No. So when Jesus says, pray that you don't have to escape in the winter months, what's he suggesting? This is going to happen, but it doesn't necessarily have to happen in the worst months of the year. In other words, God may hear your prayer, and he may, through the things that we've talked about before, through that providential working, he may ensure that when the desolation comes, it comes at, and I don't want to say this quote-unquote, at a good time of year. Not that it's going to be good, but it's a whole lot easier to flee in spring, or it's a whole lot easier to flee in summer or fall rather than winter. And as you go back and you look at what happened with the destruction, that's what occurred. You find that the destruction began in spring, ends up in summer, fall. And I think that's very interesting that the Lord said it could have been the winter, but if you pray, then there is a different outcome. Not that Jerusalem is going to avoid destruction, but there is a different outcome as far as when you're going to have to flee. And then what's the other thing? He said, pray that you don't have to escape on the Sabbath. We talked about that as far as the gates being locked up. But if you're able to flee on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday or even in this case Sunday, he said that's going to work out a whole lot better for you, so be mindful of that. And I think that's very, very interesting and very, very helpful for us today. We see a similar thing in James 5, verses 17 and 18. Remember Elijah? Did he pray a weather prayer? Pray that it wouldn't rain. So as we think about prayer, we may not always get involved with weather prayers or those kinds of things, but there are some things that are, if you will, set in stone. They are God's will. But God says that we have, through prayer, some ability to at least alter some of the details and make the situations more favorable to us. And that should be a great and encouraging lesson for us. Anything that you want to add or ask? Okay, let's take a few minutes and go back to Daniel 9 for just a minute and pick up a few things here. I kind of want to give you just a quick overview of some things there. Daniel 9. We'll read verses 24, 26, and 27 and just make a few brief comments. The 70 weeks that you sometimes hear people talking about, they are in the book of Daniel. You can see them in Daniel 9, verse 24. He says, 70 weeks are decreed upon thy people and upon the holy city to finish transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. We'll read 25 as well, though there's not much that I want to comment on. Know therefore and discern that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the anointed one, the prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It shall be built again with street and moat even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks shall the anointed one be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince that shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary and the end thereof shall be with a flood. And even unto the end shall be war. Desolations are determined. And he that make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and upon the wing of the abomination shall come one that makes desolate, and even upon the full end, and that determined shall wrath be poured out upon the desolate. Now there's a whole lot there to sort through. There's a lot of stuff really in the whole book of Daniel. But as you skim these verses, as you start back there in verse 24, you would go back several hundred years in the Old Testament and be able to kind of piece things together in such a way we actually find that the 70 weeks bring you to the time of Christ. And as you look in the middle of verse 24, did Jesus make an end of sins? Did he deal with sin? Well, yeah, that's what the Bible says he came to do, to make a reconciliation for iniquity. Well, isn't that what Christ is all about? He's paid the price for our sins. And he's brought in what kind of righteousness? There is an everlasting righteousness. So that's additional information to help us understand that Daniel was talking about the Lord. And then as you look at verses 26 and 27, it talks about the anointed one, that was Jesus. He's cut off. Well, wasn't the Lord cut off? Yeah, he was. Through the death on the cross, he shall have nothing. The people of that prince... There we go. A reference to Titus that we talked about in Matthew chapter 24. He was going to come and do what? Destroy the city. Well, that's exactly what we've discussed from Matthew 24 and the other two accounts, Mark 13 and Luke 21. The sanctuary, the end thereof, shall be a flood. When we think about the flood, there is a rush of something. Oftentimes, that's a rush of water. As we look at what happened to Jerusalem, Jesus' description, especially as we pick up with verses 21 and 22, Lord willing, next week, there was that flood of evil, that flood of destruction. And that's why Jesus referred to it as an abomination. Then in verse 27, he shall make a firm covenant with many. He's done that. In the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice, the oblation to cease. Well, he did that through Rome, didn't he? You come in, you wipe out the temple, you get rid of the sacrifices and so forth, you close the book on the Jewish people. And you see the word abominations, the desolation, and so forth. So, to sum it up there, what Daniel had predicted hundreds of years before, Jesus comes along, speaks about the same things in Matthew 24, actually refers back to Daniel, and essentially says the culmination of this is going to be in about 40 years when Rome comes against Jerusalem and attacks it.